Today on Maine Calling, the potential of 3D printing. What if there were a machine that could magically crank out whatever object you could think of, customized to you? A pair of shoes, a dental implant, a boat, even a slab of meat. Well, that machine already exists. 3D printers can do all of that and more. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we'll learn how 3D printing works and how advances in this technology are changing industries, from manufacturing to fashion to medicine. You may have heard about the University of Maine's new 3D printer. It's the world's largest of its kind, and it's capable of fabricating marine vessels and even houses. And it can produce items cheaper and faster than traditional methods. The promise of 3D printing. Maine Calling is coming right up.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Not long ago, 3D printing sounded like a novelty, something to make small plastic figurines or trinkets. Now, however, the technology has advanced and has seemingly endless potential. Today, we'll learn how 3D printing works and hear about the huge new 3D printer that University of Maine just unveiled. My guests are Dr. Habib Dogger. He's director of the Advanced Structures and Composites Center at the University of Maine, and Michael Vickery, founder and CEO at Steam Fruit in Biddeford, a design and fabrication business that utilizes 3D printing. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about 3D printing, how it works, and how it can be used? Email talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or call 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Dogger, I wanted to ask you, first off, the big news last week in 3D printing is that the University of Maine has unveiled the world's largest 3D printer, polymer printer, and it has these incredible capabilities. So tell us how this came about and what this huge printer is able to do.
Good morning, Cindy. Great to be with you here, and Michael. Yes, the printer that we showed here last week, it has a print volume of 96 feet long, 32 feet wide, and 18 feet high. So that's quite a print volume, and it can print today at about 500 pounds per hour of deposition rate. So from a polymer printer, that's a very big printer. Prior to that, we had a smaller printer, which was also the largest polymer printer in the world 3 years ago. The purpose of this printer is to allow us to look at printing housing. Housing is a big issue in Maine right now. And can we use this printer to help solve at least partly our housing crisis and make a difference in that? That's one of the areas we're looking at. But we're looking at a lot of other things, including boat building and shipbuilding and other technologies.
And this is not a future thing. You've actually already done those. You've already done a prototype of a house and built ships, correct?
That's correct. We've already produced a home. It's about a 600 square foot home, working with Maine State Housing and other partners in Maine. It's a one bedroom home that's been printed using wood waste. So we use wood waste from the sawmills in Maine that we ground up essentially and combined with a bioresin to produce this home. And it meets all the requirements of Maine State Housing. And in terms of boat building, yes, about 3 years ago, we printed a 25 foot vessel, 5,000 foot vessel, in about 3 days.
Wow. And I understand that this printer actually has a name. It's called the Factory of the Future. So it's more than just a printer. Is that right?
That's exactly right. The printer is one of the things that it does. But the Factory of the Future piece of equipment is basically a hybrid manufacturing center. In other words, it brings together multiple manufacturing processes under a digital manufacturing environment. So, for example, this printer has a printer head. That's the head that allows us to actually deposit the layers, if you wish, of material. But it can actually go out and deposit that printer head in a socket and pick up another head and do something else. So it's able to do a lot of different things based on what the project actually needs. So we can talk more about that as we move forward. So it's not just the printer, really, it's a manufacturing system or environment, if you wish, that's all digital. And that printer also can talk to the other printer and work together that you see in my background as well.
So it really is futuristic. Michael Habib was talking about the way that this works, the layers and, you know, the materials that go into it. So let's go back a little bit to basics because, you know, these 3D printers have been around now for years, but many of us have very little experience or knowledge of how it actually works. So can you give us kind of a basic primer on how a printer just creates 3D objects?
Sure. You need to start with a 3D model, first of all, and there are various ways to go about that. You either create a model in a CAD environment, or you can 3D.
Computer-aided design, right? Just to
correct,
explain,
right.
CAD, okay, yeah.
Or 3D scanning is a great tool for scanning an existing object and bringing that into the system. And there are a number of online repositories of already made models that you can download for free and bring into your software and subsequently set up for print. Now, once you have a 3D model, you need to bring it into a software program. It's called a slicer. And the slicer does exactly what the name implies. It slices the model into a number of layers. And there are a bunch of other parameters that go along with that, but that's essentially the function of the slicing program. And then what the slicer does is it exports that into basically a list of instructions for the 3D printer in the form of what's called G-code. And G-code is a fairly standardized group of codes that are used in both CNC, which is computer numerated control, like CNC routing and milling, for example, or laser cutting and things of that nature. But it also works for 3D printers. So once you have that G-code exported either onto SD card or USB stick, or send directly to the computer to the 3D printer via USB cable or network, the printer then takes those instructions and begins the print. Now, most consumer level or prosumer level printers are pretty simple mechanically. If you imagine, say, a hot glue gun or a caulking gun attached to a moving head on three axes, that's essentially what it is. So it reads the instructions that you've given it, and it lays down the first layer. Typically, for consumer-level printers, it's, you know, no more than a fraction of a millimeter high, the first layer. Sometimes you can go a little bit thicker. But from that point on, it's just a matter of layering material, one layer on top of the other, until you achieve a 3D object. That's fundamentally what it is.
Okay, so I like the hot glue gun there. For those of us who are trying to picture it, there's this little thing squirting out the material, right, in layers, just really, really, really thin layers to create this object based on the computer instructions. So, Habib, what I know yours is a polymer printer. What are the materials that are getting squirted out in creating these objects?
Certainly, what we do is we develop our own materials, modify existing materials. altogether, create new materials. We work with a variety of resin systems, anywhere from what we call low temperature thermoplastics, the glues, if you wish, or the glue gun, where it doesn't take a lot of heat essentially to get the material out, all the way to what we call aerospace grade thermoplastics, which are used on airplanes and like the Boeing jets and so on and so forth. So we use a variety of material systems depending on what the end application is, how strong it needs to be, how durable it needs to be, and so on and so forth. But one of the major material systems that we're focused on is what we call bio-based materials. Basically, they're 100% bio-based. So for example, in our housing technology, we're looking at using wood waste from the sawmills and grinding that up and then combining that with a bioresin as well. And that's what we squirt out essentially, as Michael said, from the nozzle. So essentially we're printing with wood. When you think about it, that's bonded together with that resin. So the house that we printed was just like that. The material we have is 100% recyclable as well. If you printed a house and our grandchildren 200 years from now come back and we don't want that house anymore, you can take it back and grind it up and print it again. So there's some very, very interesting opportunities to recycle, if you wish, some of these material systems and reuse them in the future. We have one of our grad students right now, she's finishing her thesis, and she's looked at recycling the materials 5 times, and then to see how the properties change every time she does that. So then she just defended her thesis. Very, very exciting opportunities here to recycle these materials or reuse them in the future. But we also use recycled materials, recycled polymers as well. We can take recycled consumer products, milk jugs and Pepsi bottles, and it's called PETG, and we can mix it also with wood waste and make things with it as well. So there's a whole opportunity here to create our own materials, if you wish, based on what the application is.
So the sustainability is very much part of what you do, is that there's no waste of these materials.
That's correct, Cindy. What we try to do is use waste streams to print with, because there's a lot of it that we're generating in society right now. I'd like to go to wood waste, for example. As you know, in Maine, we have a number of sawmills. And then a number of years ago, we had 5 pulp and paper mills shut down within a very short time, within a year or so. When you go to a sawmill, when you saw a log, a lot of that material doesn't make the grade for to be used as a 2x4 or 2x6 in construction of the home. That waste material, if you wish, used to go to the pulp and paper mills in Maine to be used to make pulp and paper. Well, right now that material exists in our sawmills, but oftentimes doesn't have a home to go to. To give you a sense of scale, how much of this we have in our region, we have close to about 1 million tons per year of this wood waste that's generated. That's enough to print 100,000 600 square foot homes.
Wow. Well, we're going to be talking with Maine Housing a little bit about the potential for that. But back to you, Mike, as far as the scale that Habib's talking mm-hmm. about with these really large objects, and you work on a much more intimate scale, and you don't have this massive 3D printer, you have something more what someone who usually would do 3D printing is working with, right? So give us tell us about the range of objects that you are making for clients or for whatever purposes.
Sure. My studio would neatly fit within the build volume of Habib's printer. There'd be no room to spare. But I service a quite a spectrum of clientele. My primary focus is industrial design and rapid prototyping. I've done work from individual garage-based inventors to multinational corporations, medical devices, orthotics, you name it, really. Anything you can imagine that would come down the pipe, it comes. So, I have 20-some-odd 3D printers in the lab. And they're all geared towards specific materials and processes. So I have a number of printers that I've particularly built out to handle TPU, which is a thermoplastic urethane. It's a flexible material. It's very useful in a lot of environments and conditions. But I also work with, as have you mentioned, PETG, that's used heavily. It's easily recyclable, and it has a lot of great characteristics for a number of applications. My largest printer has a build volume of two cubic feet as compared to Habib's massive house size printer. I also have a SLA printer, which is a resin-based printer, which relies on a laser to cure the resin into layers. It's still a layering system, but it's an entirely different process for doing so. That is really great for almost mold-quality parts and highly accurate, precise printing.
So if somebody came to you with a kind of everyday need, like I need this car part or I need to reproduce this memorabilia that, you know, I want a replica of, they just walk in with a thing and say, can you make this?
Often, yes. In fact, I get a lot of inquiries regarding out of manufactured car parts or someone that's doing some modifications. Can you do this? So yeah, it doesn't always involve 3D printing, but more often than not it does. And typically it starts with a 3D scan of an existing part and then mm-hmm. taking that to the printer, yeah.
Habib, Michael mentioned, for example, medical devices and those kind of applications. Can you just, you know, list some of those exciting applications of this technology in different fields that, you know, people may not realize you can use a 3D printer for?
Sure. There's certainly, as wild as your imagination can go, there's opportunities here for this technology. And for example, in the Department of Defense, there's a whole a group of folks actually trying to get spare parts all over the world. And then putting printers on battleships, for example. So if a part is a necessary part isn't there, then you can actually print it there on the battleship. This gives you an example of. So spare parts, as Michael just said, is a big, big issue, particularly when you have a car made, for example, that's 30 years old and you can't find a spare part for it and you want to run it. If you can take the part that's broken and print it and then put it back into your car, for example, you can get it up and running again. So these are the kinds of things, at least in the spare part business, is a big, big opportunity. But what we're working on and focusing a lot of our efforts on larger things that we can actually produce and print. As I said, housing is a big issue in Maine. There's a report that Maine State Housing had commissioned and where we need 80,000 homes in Maine by 2030. And people can't find homes today. So it's a big issue. It's a big issue for the future of our state and the young people in Maine that can't really find homes. And the issue is that we don't have enough people in the trades currently to actually build the homes that we need to build. So it's not an issue, oftentimes may not be an issue of funding. We may have the funding, we just don't have the people to build them. So this would be an opportunity not to replace existing construction, but to supplement existing construction and help more people have roofs over their head, and that's what we're looking to do. So we're not looking at this technology as replacing everything we do, but just supplementing, if you wish, and adding any more housing stock. And that's what we're focused on right now. And the other piece, Maine is a big boat building state. As you know, we have a lot of boat builders up and down the coast of Maine. And can we print boats? Can we make them faster? So can you, if you wanted a 27-foot vessel and you've got the CAD drawings and can you come back and pick it up in a month or less? So these are the kinds of things that we're focused on that are larger and they can be transformational to a number of industries.
And faster, what you're just saying, to build a boat in a record time, basically, right? So, yeah.
That's right, Cindy. You know, the first boat we printed when we 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, call it the three dirigo, was a 25-foot vessel. It's a three hull vessel. It's got three different hulls, a center hull and two side hulls. And the naval architect had never seen the boat because the person had just the drawings for him. So we made a deal with the naval architect that if it sends us the drawings, they can come and look at their boat within 2 weeks. And we did, and we started printing that boat on Thursday evening, at about 10 o'clock at Thursday night, and finished on Sunday night. So
Wow.
it was a little over a weekend, so there are real opportunities here to take these technologies, Cindy, and use them in a variety of ways to help society improve its industrial base, but also create housing opportunities for people who can't find homes now.
Yeah, so interesting. We'll talk about that more after the break. We are going to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling, and we're talking about the future of 3D printing. Call 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. With the unveiling of University of Maine's newest 3D printer, the largest in the world, we find out what 3D printing is capable of producing today and why it's already having significant impacts on fields from manufacturing to medicine. With me, Michael Vickery. He's founder of Steam Fruit in Biddeford. He utilizes 3D printing to create a range of products. And Dr. Habib Dogher is director of the University of Maine's Advanced Structures and Composites Center, known as ASCC. Share your thoughts and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. And we have calling in now. This is Mark Wiesendonger. He is the Director of Development at Maine Housing. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Happy to be here, Cindy.
So you heard Dr. Dogher mentioning the potential for the new UMaine 3D printer to be used to manufacture houses. Do you see this at Maine Housing? Is it a real possibility that it can really help supply housing and help with the housing shortage in Maine?
Absolutely. And Habib spoke to it a second ago and mentioned that a recent study said that we need about 80,000 more units of housing in Maine by 2030. And I would say a large portion of those are for those at lower income levels as well. Habib and I have been talking about this for 4 or 5 years now. And the reality is, it's very expensive to create housing of any type today. You know, we were talking earlier about the need for housing for workers here. The cost of construction has gone up rather dramatically. And we don't have enough people in this state doing that work. So this is an opportunity to, you know, add an arrow to the quiver, if you will, another way to create housing, also to quickly create housing so some of those workers can come into the state and work in the construction trades as well. We definitely see a lot of potential here, and I do believe that as the technology develops, and Habib and his team are really doing a great job of this, we're going to see that the cost on a per unit basis can come down rather dramatically.
Any way of estimating what that might be, what the cost for an actual finished 3D printed home would be?
That remains to be seen. I think we're
Okay.
still working through the numbers, and until this is really scaled up and we can figure out how much, you know, overhead costs are going to be, for instance, and you know, these are going to be large businesses with expensive equipment, but I think with the quantity that they can put out in a short period of time, it can drive the incremental cost down over time. So hold tight. We'll let you know soon when we get those numbers.
All right, and I know the plans are in the works, but is there a vision for how these would be used as far as would it like be little clusters of them? And you know, how would what do you envision as the actual applications of this?
Well, interestingly, the first house that was printed meets our design requirements at Maine Housing. So yes, in parts of the state where land is less expensive, for instance, you could have individual rental units in like a little neighborhood, a little cluster of homes. But I think as the technology develops over time and there's more time spent on the design and engineering of it, it could probably translate into modular construction as well and be used in larger buildings.
Great. Well, we'll talk more with Habib about that, but thank you for giving that perspective. That was Mark Wiesendonger. He is the Director of Development for Maine Housing. And Habib, I know, as Mark was saying, it's hard to say how much a house would cost, depending on what it is and all of that. But can you give us just a sense of how much cheaper, you know, percentage-wise it might be than a conventional home?
As Mark said, you know, the jury's still out in terms of how much cheaper it will be, but certainly our goal is to be at least as cost-effective as current homes or potentially less. And we believe there's an opportunity to do that. As Mark said, the key here is to scale up the production and the volume, and that's what we're working on. That's why we have this bigger printer that we just discussed. When we printed the first home that Mark was referring to, we started depositing material at 20 pounds per hour. And by the time we finished printing that house, we were depositing material at 120 pounds per hour. And then most recently, over the last couple of months, we're able to reach 500 pounds per hour of deposition rate. So from 20 to 500 pounds an hour, to give you a sense of, and that's going to change the cost significantly, the cost structure, because if that machine now, the same machine can produce 500 pounds an hour versus 20 pounds an hour, you can produce that many more homes with the same equipment. So that's where we're heading, is really scaling up the manufacturing process to drive the cost down.
And just to be clear, so it's not like this printer just pops out of house. It's parts, and do they fit together, or do you still need labor to nail things together? How does that finished product come about?
Great question, Cindy. The one that we did, the BioHome 3D house that we printed, we worked with Maine State Housing to figure out how big it needs to be. Does it meet all the requirements for geometry and size and so forth? Then we asked ourselves, what's the best way to get it out there? So we broke it up into three pieces. So the house was broken into three pieces that you could put on a truck and get on the road. So think of it as modular housing that's 3D printed. So those three pieces were put on a truck each and placed on the foundation that we had prepared. And they were simply bolted together. So it took less than half a day to bolt the modules together, and they were designed to be bolted. And then we had pre-installed electrical wiring in each one of the three modules. And pre-installed insulation in the modules as well. We used bio-insulation. So when the modules were bolted together, then we had one electrician arrive to the site, and within 2 hours, we had electricity running at the house. So try to prefabricate, if you wish, as much as we can. Now, we installed the kitchen and the plumbing, if you wish, after the house was assembled on site, so you could do that. So you can have the plumbers arrive and kitchen installers, just like you would with a normal home. You could do it that way. Or as we get better at it, you can potentially pre-install the kitchens and the plumbing in the house before you take it out in pieces. So
I have to say the pictures of the prototype are very cool looking. So if anybody's curious about what Habib's describing, you see the wood composite, and that's really amazing to see. That's coming out of a 3D printer. So Google it if you you look up 3D printed home Maine, right? And you'll pop up a picture of that. Let's go to Stephanie calling from Augusta. Hi, Stephanie. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to know?
Well, I wanted to say that what these gentlemen are doing and women are commendable. It's commendable to work on the issue of housing in our state. Also, I have a question. Do they use the resin-based process to do the housing project?
Habib.
Yes, we use a bioresin to combine with the wood waste. That would, if you should, takes the wood and glues it together, in essence. And it's a bioresin as well that's 100% recyclable. So, yes, that's
wonderful,
correct.
Wonderful. Now, has anybody done any work on scanning organs?
Medical organs? 3D printing?
Yeah,
them?
Medical organs.
Right,
is
I
that
think
even
that's
possible?
What she's...
There is work ongoing to actually do grow medical organs right now in a variety of places across the country and the world. And certainly that's a as far as I know, none of them has been implanted in anyone yet, but there's quite a bit of work going on in that space.
Thanks for calling, Stephanie. And I did read in doing research for the show that they created a 3D heart model that's very exact to a specific person so that you can use that to create an aortic valve, for example, something that somebody needs it to fit exactly. So it's just amazing. We also have a related question about medical applications from, this is an email from Carla. I'm very excited about the potential that 3D printing has for the medical world. I wonder if in the future, 3D printers could create a substitute for cartilage for those with connective tissue disorders. I'm curious what substances can be used in a 3D printer. Is there some flexibility in using substances with different characteristics? My own daughter suffers from slipping rib syndrome, where the cartilage that connects the false ribs to the sternum has broken down. There's a delicate balance between needing something that is rigid to hold the ribs in place with something elastic enough to allow some movement when breathing. And Michael, I don't know if, and you know, you've obviously used a lot of different substances and different levels of flexibility. Do you think that potentially that's something that could be created?
Yeah, I think it is potentially doable, but I don't know that it would be with the use of a polymer of any sort. I think it'd be more about tissue printing. And, you know, that's something they're already working with, culturing tissues in lab and running them through essentially a nozzle onto a pre-shaped matrix to shape the cells and tissue build, essentially. So yeah. I think it's going in that direction. I think it'll be some time before we see that actually in a patient of any kind. But, you know, you can run virtually any kind of material through a 3D printing mechanism. It's all a matter of configuring the print head to manage that particular material. So it's certainly possible.
I understand, yeah, that customization aspect of it means that people also can make prosthetics that are specific to somebody. Right. So another medical application. Well, if somebody, I'm going to stick with you, Michael, for this. If someone purchases a 3D printer of their own to use, how hard is it to learn how to use it?
Well, it's getting easier all the time. I'll say that. If anybody's gone shopping for a 3D printer, you see pretty quickly that it's a paradox of options. There's just the market is just flooded with consumer level printers of every imaginable sort and configuration. So I think it's worthwhile to start simple, but don't necessarily go cheap. Because you want success. I hear too many stories of people diving into 3D printing without doing much research, maybe have success with one or two prints, and then the printer begins collecting dust because they've run into some sort of technical issue or another. So, you know, pay attention to the reviews. There are lots of resources on YouTube related to unboxing and setting up printers of various brands and types. Bottom line, do a little research first. Have a sense of what it is you're looking to print, and then do your shopping. But yeah, the technology is almost at the point where you can set it and forget it, but not what I would say quite there yet.
Okay.
It's not like... Not like a
super
microwave.
Easy. Yeah, okay. Well, we'll talk more about that after the break. Yeah. Give us a call with your questions or comments about 3D printing. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're discussing the capabilities of 3D printing and how it's revolutionizing different industries. Joining me, Habib Dagher with UMaine's Advanced Structures and Composite Center. He's behind the university's new massive 3D printer known as Factory of the Future. And Michael Vickery is with Steamfruit in Biddeford. He produces items using 3D printing technology. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. And let's go now to the phone lines again. This is Jeff calling from Portland. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thank you for the call. I was wondering if, especially when it comes to housing, and I assume there's a limited amount of materials that can be fed through these 3D printers, I wonder if the materials used have been examined for outgassing and potential toxic effects from long-term exposure. We've had, you know, a number of building trade issues in the past where that occurred, and of course there's PFASs and these other things. What have you looked into in terms of long-term health exposure for someone living in a 3D printed home?
Thanks for your question, Jeff. Habib, is that something being researched?
Yes, indeed, Jeff. You're asking an extremely important question, and we're concerned not only in people living in the home, but actually producing the house. As you're producing this home, are you concerned about emissions from the production, from the manufacturing process that could be an issue? So we're spending a lot of effort on those issues, but the good news is the materials we're printing with are wood, essentially. Our goal is to be about 50 to 60% wood by weight. And the other is a bioresin. So it's a very, these bioresins you can actually eat out of, use them as a plate to eat out of, or make them out of straws and so on and so forth. They've been used in the past and have been approved for consumer product applications because they are non-toxic. So the materials we're starting with are non-toxic material systems. Yet at the same time, we are studying the exposures. The biggest concerns we have is during the manufacturing process, because you have high temperature and high heat, and you're concerned about emissions during the manufacturing process. So we have sensors right around the printer that are sniffing, if you wish, particles anywhere from the micro-sized to the nano-sized particles, and to see if there's any issues. And so far, we haven't seen issues during the manufacturing process. Now, when the house is completed and built as well, we've been monitoring the house, the environment in the house, and have not seen any issues yet within the house that we built here about a year and a quarter ago. So we're comfortable today that there are no red flags, if you wish, going forward. It doesn't mean we're gonna stop at that. We're gonna continue to monitor and evaluate. So.
Great, thanks for that call, Jeff, and thanks for that answer, Habib. We have now on the line Emma Marie Banks. She's with the Maine Department of Education, and she coordinates the DOE's Learning Through Technology program and specializes in digital learning and computer science. Thanks for giving us a call, Emma.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So for some of us, this all still sounds like science fiction, but students these days see 3D printing as just one of the skills they can learn at school. And what are Maine's K through 12 students learning about 3D printing?
Well, we could spend the rest of the time digging into that. That's for sure. There's lots that's being learned through 3D printing. However, I would say some of our most exciting things are anywhere from, you know, what we would call a substitution of using 3D printing in place of something they used to do. So, like, remember creating a model of a cell, right, back in the day. And most of the time, you know, when I was in school, we would write it on paper. Now they can actually create 3D cell models. I've seen some of those. Those are really cool. We also see any sort of creativity, from jewelry to, you know, fishing lures to tools for art projects. We see personalized gifts for Mother's Day. There's lots. And then, you know, you get into more of the traditional STEM focused stuff. So designing, you know, bridges and looking at architecture. And you also have like the CAD skills that go along with it. So learning some of the software and computer science skills that are kind of backing the 3D skills that they develop. It's really exciting. And I would say that we also have our students, that is one thing that really sparks their interest. Anytime that they're told, oh, I get to like create something and then print it on this cool 3D printer and then it's mine, I get to take it home. So it's also a great like intro to the computer science world and a more deeper dive into technology for students that may not otherwise see themselves in that space.
Well, that's great. I'm going to actually ask you one of our listeners' questions, because you've sort of touched on it. This is an email from James. He says, if someone wanted to explore 3D printing for the sake of creativity, what or how would somebody begin? Is there a checklist of what's needed? So any tips for James on how he could do something more artistic with a 3D printer?
Yeah, certainly. So there are lots of things that resources you can find on the internet for that. But if you're in a classroom setting, you know, having those conversations with your, you know, visual arts teachers about what are they already teaching and how do we get some 3D printing kind of baked into that. I would also say that, you know, there are 3D printers available in a lot of local libraries nowadays. And so, like, if you're not connected directly with an education environment, there are still opportunities for you to kind of explore 3D printing without having to go and invest in a 3D printer and, like, master how to use it by yourself. But really, you know, the sky's the limit of what you can do with it. So creativity is certainly, it's all about what you can think of to do with it.
And do most schools in Maine have a 3D printer or many 3D printers? It seems like it's a pretty expensive thing to keep up with.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, they've gotten a lot more affordable over the past few years. I've seen the costs go down substantially. I would say that most schools have at least one 3D printer, certainly not all schools. You know, that's something that we work on at the department through grants and opportunities that we can help to provide. And then there are some schools who have, you know, a handful of 3D printers and they 3D print as part of their curriculum. So it really depends on how well a school has integrated 3D printing as to, you know, the budget justification, right? If it's a critical component of the student's learning, then they're going to find room in their budget for it. So,
wow, great to hear about all of that. Thank you so much for calling. That was Emma Marie Banks, and she's with the Maine Department of Education. We have more questions coming in about the houses. I think you've piqued people's interest, Habib. So email from Earl, how does the printed house compare with the traditional units being produced in Maine? So are these drastically different sci-fi looking houses or they look like a house?
Very good question, Cindy. The opportunity to really be able to do things that are unique and different and architecturally is open with 3D printers because you don't have to have curves and shapes and can be anything. But BioHome 3D, the very first home we did, we kept it somewhat traditional, but also used curved features. So the wall to roof cross section is not a straight line; it's a curved piece here, and people really love the curves when they go into the house. They also like the feel of the structure because it looks like wood that's curved, if you wish, inside a house. So there's a lot of warm feeling, if you wish, for the home. But we can do anything from being traditional to being very unique with the 3D printer, and that's the advantage of that technology. So.
But generally, size-wise, you're still talking about something that compares to a tiny home, right? Or bigger maybe than a mobile home?
Yeah, certainly. That's what we started with right now. The very first home we printed, we wanted to crawl before we walk, if you wish. So we started with a 600-square-foot home and a one-bedroom that met all the requirements of Maine State Housing. But the new printer we have is able to print something that's 96 feet long and 32 feet wide and 18 feet high. So when you think about that 96 by 32, that's almost a 3,000 square foot home on one floor. So,
wow.
So you can do bigger things. But we started to be modest and careful, if you wish, and now we're scaling up.
And we have a question here from email from Christy. I have a background in fashion, and I read that soon we'll be able to 3D print our clothes. Will this happen in our lifetime? Michael, is that actually happening already, I think?
Yeah, Cindy, I think, you know, if you look at, you know, the high fashion industry, you see that happening already. You see it on the runways now. Lots of like chainmail almost fabrics. You know, but as the technology advances, I think, yeah, potentially you can see some very compelling uses towards fashion and fashion design.
And also customizing, again, the size, shape of everything
right.
Would be to
absolutely.
The person. Right. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, you can 3D print all the accompanying accessories. You know, the buttons and whatnot, and even integrate 3D printed features into the fabric. So there's so many ways it can be implemented.
Sky's the limit. So let's go to Steve now, calling in from Topsom. Hi, Steve.
Hello, I'm calling about the housing, and I'm curious if the housing that's printed is similar to housing that we stick built. Are there studs, or is there sheathing of similar dimensions, and is the sheath the studs, or does it have to be nailed? And also, I'm curious about the weight of the houses that they're printing. Because you're taking them over the road, I'm wondering if they're lighter or heavier than your traditional modular home. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for asking, Steve. And Habib, you touched upon how they're assembled, but you can answer Steve's questions.
Sure, Steve, good questions. The first question about how it's built, does it have wood studs? Does it have studs in it? No, what we have is we build it like a cavity, if you wish. The walls are made with a cavity between an outer skin and an inner skin. And between the cavities, we have a truss, if you wish. It's a truss structure between the two. And the wall truss turns into the roof truss. So you can change the depth of the truss if you wanted to. You can have we did a 10-inch truss for the roof in this case that was printed, but you can go to 20 inches if you wanted to as well and have more insulation in it. So it's a truss structure that we're using versus a stud wall type structure. And in terms of the weight, they're very similar to the weight of traditional homes. So they, in terms of getting them on the road with modular housing, it would be very similar in terms of weight. So.
Great. Thanks for your call, Steve. And let's see, there is a question. Oh, let's go to Joanne. Joanne's calling from Addison. Hi, Joanne. What did you want to know?
Hi. A couple of things. I'm wondering if they're doing anything with the what has been damaged and destroyed from the recent storms along the coast, and how maybe rebuilds and repairs fit in with that's one question, but then even thinking about new roofs needed on old houses, how that's a possibility with new materials on old situations.
Okay, great. Thank you for asking. And Habib, that is happening to some degree as well, isn't it?
Yes, certainly. These are really good questions. In terms of working with damaged infrastructure right now, we have some technologies we've developed to actually do repair culverts, for example. That's already been tried in the state of Maine. So we place an insert inside a culvert, an existing culvert that matches the culvert, that makes it so that you can increase the flow in the culvert by 30%. So if you have an extreme storm, you're less likely to flood the road, for example. So that's something that's been printed with bio-based resins already and been tried with the Maine Department of Transportation and also in other New England states. So we're moving in that direction to try to make roads less likely to flood, if you wish, by using this technology. So that in terms of making pieces of homes that you can actually replace on an existing home, so that's certainly a possibility. We're not doing it right now, but we are working, for example, with architectural firms that are using 3D printing for flooring, floor cassettes of high-rise buildings. So these are companies that actually prefabricate a high-rise building in modules that using steel framework. And the floor systems that go into that currently have 50 pieces in them in one floor system. And we can take 50 pieces and turn them into one. And so we are making pieces of homes, if you wish, and in the future, it's certainly a possibility to potentially replace the roof on an existing home with a technology like that, even though we haven't done that yet.
Thanks for your call, Joanne. And along those lines also, I've heard that supply chain issues that we're seeing that are so gumming up the works, that will also be helped by being able to just crank out 3D printed materials. So I just wanted a quick fun question for you, Michael, to close out the show. Is there, out of the things that you've made, since there's so many different kinds, anything either unusual or fun or interesting that you want to just give an example of?
Probably one of the most interesting and challenging things I worked on was a replica of the clock that stands within Grand Central Station, a smaller replica thereof. I searched high and low for drawings Hoping I could make it an easier go, but no, I had to work from photographs and build it entirely from scratch. But it's fully functional, four-face, lit from within, miniature of that particular clock.
Wow, that's very cool. Oh, hubby, we have 10 seconds. Go ahead.
Just for fun, we've also printed two bears, 3D printed bears at the University of Maine. There's a new hotel on the university campus. We have a mama bear and a baby bear, if you wish. If you come up, you'll be able to see them. So made with bio-based materials.
That's great. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Dr. Habib Dagher with the University of Maine. Michael Vickery is with Steam Fruit in Biddeford. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris, and you can go to mainecalling.org to find our past shows. Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn all about some of Maine's most important and interesting court cases. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.